Docket number 24-2234, Evolve Wireless LLC versus Samsung Electronics America Incorporated. Mr. Fowler.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The Court should reverse the District Court's summary judgment on license because the District Court misread the Qualcomm agreement as creating surviving patent license rights that survive the termination of the agreement. The Court should also reverse the denial of a new trial because the verdict was against the great weight of the evidence on infringement, and the Court should affirm the written description judgment. And I'll take the issues in that order unless the Court directs me otherwise.
I do have a housekeeping question for you, counsel. A number of things are marked, especially with respect to license agreement, as confidential, but for us to be able to have a fruitful discussion today, it'd be helpful if the parties would agree that we could talk about the key terms. Is that something I assume you have no objection to, both sides?
That's fine with Walt. I think that's right. I think we can discuss it in a way that...
Can I address the bench?
Yep.
We have no objection. I think that we're talking about two contract provisions, and I believe that is okay to talk about.
Great. So turning to the contract issue...
Could I... maybe this is housekeeping, too. I don't know. I'm just not clear on why we would even need to reach the license issue unless you can persuade us that there should be a new trial on infringement. Hasn't your infringement theory already been tried? It's the exact same theory, as I understand it, for the Qualcomm chips as the non-Qualcomm chips. So unless we're ordering a new trial, why would we even have to consider the license?
Because the non-infringement judgment does not apply to the products with Qualcomm chips. The judgment is strictly limited to the products with Qualcomm chips.
Counsel, are you contending you have any different non-infringement arguments for the Qualcomm chips from what was handled with respect to the judgment?
There's none in the record as it stands right now, but there was no opportunity in the district court. Samsung didn't raise the issue of whether the non-infringement finding should also apply to the products with Qualcomm chips. And we believe that we would be entitled to...
Hey, whoever has the phone or whatever, like, please. Thank you.
So we believe we'd be entitled to the opportunity to oppose in the district court something like...
Is there anything different about the products with the Qualcomm chips? Let me just ask it that way. In terms of the non-infringement arguments, is there anything different about them?
Of all the products, we used a standard-based read. But
it's the same standard for the Qualcomm chips as the non-Qualcomm chips, and your time for articulating a different, materially different infringement theory presumably came and went as you were getting ready for trial. So wouldn't it be... just a waste of judicial resources. Again, this is all on the assumption. Don't read too much into that, but an assumption that you don't persuade us you should get a new trial, not clear to me why there's anything left to do on the license question.
Well, two points, Your Honor. First, I think given that applying non-infringement to a set of products that were not adjudged non-infringing in the district court would broaden the relief. The license ground is a narrower ground for judgment for Samsung than a non-infringement finding. So we believe it would have been incumbent.
Put that to the side. What's your second point?
Second point is whether or not the court ultimately applies the non-infringement finding more broadly. We don't think it should, and we don't think the finding should stand anyway. The license issue is still not moot under the doctrine of Cardinal versus Morton, Supreme Court case 1993. There are sound finality reasons for the court to reach and decide the license issue regardless. So we do believe the court should reach and decide the license issue no matter what it does on infringement.
Just to be clear, there's nothing in the record that suggests that Evolved ever had any additional grounds or theories of infringement for the Qualcomm products compared to the accused products that were actually litigated at trial. Is that fair to say?
I wouldn't quite go that far because the record
is... Let's put it this way. Neither you nor I know of anything in the record right now that would indicate or suggest that Evolved ever had a second additional layer of infringement theories solely against the Qualcomm products that's different from what was actually litigated as the infringement theory against the non-Qualcomm products. Is that fair to say?
That's correct, but I do think the record is undeveloped on that issue, not fully developed, and so we'd need a determination by the district court. That's our position. So,
what do you contend about the record was not developed? Like, what was the timing of when that case ended, such that the record would not have been developed?
Well, just for example, Your Honor, if Samsung had presented to the district court an argument, hey, we think this non-infringement finding should apply to the Qualcomm products after the trial, we at that point might have had reasons to oppose that we did not get the chance to develop. For example,
I mean, I don't want you to give me examples in that sense, the way you're kind of doing it, but I want to just kind of know where the case was when Qualcomm fell out, and like in terms of like discovery that happened.
Oh, it was right. It was just a couple of weeks before trial. Yes, I'm not taking the position that discovery wasn't over. I agree with that.
And am I correct? My recollection is you reserved a right that if you won at trial on the non-Qualcomm chips, to ask the court to extend that same finding of infringement in that instance to the Qualcomm chips, which again seems to suggest your theory was completely identical.
We did proffer an exhibit that listed all the products out. That's all we did. During that same exchange, the district court, and this is in Appendix 3914, observed that the only products before the jury in this trial are the non-Qualcomm products.
But to answer Judge Stark's question directly, did you ask for it to extend if you won?
I don't think that request per se is in the record. I mean, we just
I'm not hearing whether or not it's in like the JA or a record. Do you know if you asked that or if your side asked that or not?
All we did was proffer an exhibit. All we said was we want this in the record. I mean, I think the implication
was... For what
purpose? I think the implication is certainly that, you know, we wanted to preserve the ability to ask for that. Yes. Let me just talk a little bit about the merits of the license issue. It really all comes down to Section, I think, 5.3 of the 2004 amendment to the contract. And that provision does not create new surviving license rights. The way this Section 5 works, 5.1 and 5.2 are the grant of license rights. Those contain, you know, the covenants not to sue that are operative. Then Section 5.3, which is what Samsung hangs its hat on, is a restriction on transferring patents. It basically says the parties can't sell the patents that are subject to these covenants unless the patents remain subject to the covenants that I just described in 5.1 and 5.2, as the case may be for the life of such patent.
Why doesn't 5.3 just stand for the proposition that any transfer of these patents, any assignments of these patents, will not disrupt the covenant rights that have been granted to Qualcomm under 5.1 and 5.2 for the life of those patents?
Well, I think what the provision does is it applies 5.1 and 5.2 to any patents that are transferred. I think that's exactly what it does. But 5.1 and 5.2, everyone agrees, terminate when the underlying contract terminates. And so all 5.3 does is say the same rights that apply to all other patents apply to patents that are sold. We believe the life of such patent language aligns the license term for patents that LG sells during the license term with the license term that applies to all other patents, which under the agreement was a de facto life of patent license unless the underlying agreement terminated.
10.3, where 10.3 seemed to say any termination under any circumstances of the amendment will nevertheless all rights granted under Section 5 are going to be protected.
So 10.3, I think Samsung and the district court just lopped off the end of 10.3, which says when the amendment terminates, it applies to the amendment, not the underlying agreement. It says that when the amendment terminates, the rights under the amendment will also terminate, except for a few listed sections. And then here's the part that the district court lops off.
What I'm trying to understand is the provision says, upon any termination of the amendment, and then why couldn't a termination of the entire agreement, which also would necessarily result in a termination of the amendment, apply to the provisions of 10.3?
Because what 10.3 contemplates is the surviving sections survive as amendments to the underlying agreement. That language is right there in the provision. It says, let me find the text. It says that the license agreement shall remain, the 1993 original license agreement shall remain in full force and effect as it existed prior to the amendment, except as amended by the surviving section. So what that section contemplates is that the parts of the amendment that survive only survive as amendments to the underlying agreement. If the underlying agreement terminates, those surviving sections terminate too. So,
isn't 5.3 one of the 2004 amended provisions?
It is, Your Honor. So 5.3 would survive a termination of the amendment.
But 5.1 and 5.2 would not, is your view?
Actually, all of Section 5 is designated as a surviving section, which I think undercuts the district court's reasoning and Samsung's argument, because by the district court's reasoning, all of the licenses, including 5.1 and 5.2, which was basically the core exchange of consideration under this agreement, would survive a termination, meaning a termination would be fairly pointless. It would achieve virtually nothing because the entire exchange of cross licenses would survive, and that reading doesn't make any sense.
Counsel, it doesn't say that every single term would survive. It just calls out certain ones that would survive. So I'm not sure that your argument is well taken, that you think a termination would mean nothing.
Well, it includes all of Section 5. So not just Section 5.3, which is what Samsung contends creates this life of patent springing license. It also includes 5.1 and 5.2,
All the protections that Qualcomm negotiated for through this amendment, right? I mean, part of the whereas clause recitals talk about how there's a story behind why we're doing this 2004 amendment, because the parties, there seems to be a dispute over what the original license covers, but Qualcomm's going to agree to take a haircut when it comes to the royalty payments it's entitled to for its patents, its cross-licensing, but at the same time, it's trying to make sure it's never going to be bugged again by these LG patents. I mean, that's kind of what the whereas clause seems to be indicating.
Sure, but there's nothing in this agreement that suggests that when the ultimate underlying deal terminates, the license rights should survive. This is all against the backdrop of the provision 15.5 in the original agreement that very clearly expresses the party's intent that if the underlying agreement terminates, all patent license rights shall also terminate and the parties shall immediately stop using each other's IP. That provision continues to control. There's nothing in any of these amendments that contradicts.
How do we interpret the for the life of such patent that's in Section 5.3?
It just aligns the license term for patents that LG sells with the license term that applies to every other patent. It's not meant to create some kind of new springing license rights. There were very clear ways that the parties...
If I followed you, you just said there's no indication that the parties thought that any of these licenses should extend beyond the termination of the agreement. But as Judge Cunningham just pointed out, the phrase for the life of the patent is right there in 5.3. And the life of the patent may be longer than the effectiveness of the agreement, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but that's only applying the specific covenants in the agreement, 5.1 and 5.2, to those patents for their life, but only insofar as 5.1 and 5.2 exist, and everybody agrees 5.1 and 5.2 terminate when the underlying agreement terminates.
Could I ask a question about infringement?
Sure.
Thank you. Because you're here also arguing for a new trial on infringement, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
One of your arguments throughout the brief is that Samsung supposedly duped and deceived the jury and presumably Judge Gilstrap as well by putting on a whole bunch of evidence about base stations when really the case was about phones. Do I have to be persuaded that everybody was duped and deceived in order for you to prevail on this argument?
I don't think that would be one way to reverse, but I think just the weight of the evidence, whether you believe there was some
kind of... Well, it's not weight of the evidence. You have, under Fifth Circuit law, as I understand it, you have to persuade me there's basically no evidence in support of infringement. And I took it the only way you could show that, but this is my question. Can you show that there's no evidence to support infringement if I'm not persuaded that the jury was duped and deceived?
Yes, I don't think our argument requires duped or deceived. I think it requires that Samsung's expert presented a theory that collapsed on cross-examination and made no sense, was self-contradictory, and I think that's enough to reverse without finding some kind of deception.
But are you contending that there's an absolute absence of evidence of infringement?
Yes, I think that sets the bar a little too high. I think the standard is that the court abused its discretion in not finding that the verdict was against the great weight of the evidence. I don't dispute that that's a high standard. It is, but I don't think it's quite as high as an absolute absence. But even if it were, I believe that standard is satisfied.
Absolute absence of evidence of non-infringement. I want to be more precise, right?
Yes, and I do think for the reasons we lay out in our brief, there is no evidence of non-infringement. I believe the only thing presented of non-infringement with regard to the accused phones was this mask index theory that was self-contradictory and objectively wrong for the reasons we lay out in the brief.
Well, there's a mask index theory, and there's also the theory that there was that contention-free handovers were not occurring in certain regions of the country.
Yes, Your Honor.
There was also your expert's statement at some point that contention-free handovers are optional under the LTE standard.
And that's all that misleading base station stuff, Your Honor. It's undisputed.
But your expert, that came out of his own mouth, that the contention-free handover is an optional
but only
for LTE standard.
But only for base stations, Your Honor. It was undisputed, and
I don't know what that means, only for base stations. The base station and the handheld phones, they're operating together.
Yes, but every phone has to be capable of, which is the standard for apparatus claims drawn to capability.
Right, but if the inquiry is the inquiry that was part of the jury instruction, it's not objected to and it's not here on appeal, which is that, you know, that there every technical implementation of the standard has to meet your patent claims. And if they're in fact under the LTE standard, there's a way for the phones and base stations to talk to each other without using contention-free handovers, then isn't that a problem?
It's not under the reasoning of FinGen versus Secure Computer, which is that if a apparatus claim drawn to capability is configured to or reasonably capable of performing the steps, which the phones here were undisputedly.
You're resisting the jury instruction, which was following the INVT.
I don't think I am, Your Honor. It's just that even under the jury instruction, a possible non-infringing mode of operation wouldn't defeat infringement. That's not how claims drawn to capability work. It is impossible to have an LTE compliant phone that isn't capable of this handover procedure, even if it is also capable of non-infringing operation, which would not defeat infringement.
Okay. You're out of time, but we'll make sure you have some rebuttal time, okay?
Thank you, Judge Chen, and may it please the Court, John Bash for the appellee in this case. As anticipated by the questions of Judge Cunningham and Judge Stark, I think the shortest path to affirmance of the non-infringement portion of the judgment in this case is to first hold that Judge Gilstrap did not abuse his discretion in denying the motion for a new trial, which, Judge Cunningham, you are right, under the Fifth Circuit's function media standard, that overlay of abuse of discretion on the new trial standard equates to absolute absence of evidence. They conceded below at 126 of the appendix that we at least had some evidence. And then two, as the questions anticipated, to say there's absolutely no reason in the world that that standard would not apply to the Qualcomm chip products, which are materially indistinguishable. Let me take each of those in terms. The briefing, I think, on appeal, Evolved has done a good job at muddying the multiple alternative grounds for affirming the jury verdict. There's been a lot of this dispute about optionality. That's really the third alternative ground. If you look at page 137 of the appendix, Judge Gilstrap gave the two primary grounds for finding evidence of non-infringement. The first was this. The other side conceded, and this is at page 3826 and forward of the record, that a preamble, this long string of numbers, had to be dedicated to one phone for the entire Ratch preamble handover. That's a 26-millisecond process. We submitted expert testimony, and this is found at two places, first at page 4269 and forward, then at page 4329 and forward of the record, that the way LTE works is it can assign the same preamble to two different phones. During the Ratch procedure, it tries to avoid collision by assigning them to different time slots. The other side's expert at page 3834 of the record conceded that LTE allows two preambles to be given, the same preamble to be given to two phones during the same Ratch procedure. That is more than sufficient to affirm the judgment. Judge Gilstrap.
What was the JA site for that?
3834 of the record. And we asked on cross their expert, Ms. Dr. Jones, directly, can the same preamble be assigned to two different phones within the Ratch procedure? Of course, I'm paraphrasing. And he said, yes. That's at page 3834 of the appendix in this case. So that's alone sufficient. Judge Gilstrap cited that at page 137. And, of course, Judge Gilstrap, who is not going to be duped by anybody's evidence, at 128 said we had copious evidence of non-infringement. The second ground, and again, this is before we get to the optionality dispute between the parties. The second ground is in order to distinguish prior art, they conceded that there had to be a zero risk of collisions in the LTE standard to satisfy the claims. That's at page 3681 and forward of the record. We submitted evidence, and this is at page 4276 to 78 of the record, that there is a possibility of collisions under LTE, and it's that time slot thing I just talked about, which is that where the same preamble for different phones is slotted into adjacent time slots. They're called subframes, technically. There is a risk of collision. Now, the jury, I'm not saying we were entitled to JMOL because of that. The jury was free to believe us. It was free to believe them. That's clearly not an absolute absence of evidence, which is the standard. Again, I think we win on either of those grounds. If we get to the optionality point, it is true, and I will concede this for my opponents, their expert, Judge Chen, conceded optionality on the base stations. He did not concede it's an optional capability for the phone. The problem for them is our expert did say it was optional for the phones. That's at page 4324 of our expert's testimony. He said it's something that the carriers might require manufacturers to include. It's optional for the phones. What their expert did concede at page 3773 of the record, and this is one of the supplemental pages we just added because they were mistakenly omitted from the record, their expert conceded that his theory was based solely on essentiality. Well, we put in evidence to the record that it's optional even for the phones. They dispute that. But we're not asking for JMOL. They're asking for an absolute absence of evidence. You're right on the jury instruction. The jury instruction, which Judge Chen, by the way, tracks your opinion in INVT.
The court's opinion.
I'm sorry. The opinion you authored for the court in INVT. 4 years ago said for essentiality, it's got every possible implementation, has to infringe. That is not true here under the testimony we presented. The last thing I'd say, and this is in some sense a fourth alternative ground to affirm the jury's verdict, They make a lot about the mask index, and it matters. If mask index is always zero, it's not doing anything. Now, that's wrong on its own terms, because what's doing something is the fact that there are different time slots, because that's what creates the risk of collision, and that's what creates what we call the shared preamble. What the mask index does is close off particular time slots if the mask index is more than zero. And they say, well, it's zero, so it's not doing anything. Well, it is doing something, because by letting all of those time slots be open, it creates the risk of collision, which takes it out of the claims. But even if the court somehow thought that the mask index being zero...
Does mask index zero create the opportunity for a collision?
Because what the mask index zero does is open up all the time slots. And so the more time slots open, the more of a risk of collision, because the more of a chance that the same preamble will be slotted into adjacent time slots. For example, if nine of the time slots were closed and only every tenth were open, there would be less of a risk of collisions. But the other point I was going to make is, even if the court thought I was wrong about all that and thought it matters that the time slot is zero, I don't think it does, but it matters that the mask index is zero, we submitted expert testimony at page 4441 that the LTE standard does not require the mask index to be zero. It may often be in practice. And again, their claim is based entirely on essentiality. So even if it mattered, which it doesn't, that the mask index is zero, that's not an essential feature of the LTE standard anyway. So for those four independent reasons, the court should clearly affirm the judgment of non-infringement.
The LTE standard says, quote unquote, dedicated preamble, does it not?
It uses the phrase dedicated preamble, but as you know, Judge Chen, it's not a word matching game. And what Evolved conceded in their expert testimony, I believe this is at page 3826 and forward of the record, is that dedicated preamble for the claims means that it has to be only one, assigned to one phone for the entire RACE procedure. And that is not true in the LTE standard. So they may use
the
same.
What does the LTE standard say about what the standard means when the standard says dedicated preamble?
Well, what our expert explained was that the LTE standard...
Is the standard silent as to what the standard means when it says dedicated preamble?
I don't recall, Judge Chen, if it has like a definitional provision, which is, I think, what you're asking, but the way it works is that it allows the same preamble to be assigned to different phones within the same RACE procedure. They conceded that is not a dedicated preamble within the meaning of the claims.
Dedicated must mean something in the LTE standard. You're saying what it means is any old phone can use the same preamble as other phones during the same RACE procedure, and that doesn't really give any meaning to the word dedicated.
Oh, I'm sorry, Judge Chen, I understand the question now. It does mean something, because the same preamble can't be in the same time slot. So it's dedicated in the sense that within one RACE procedure, only the time slot will take only one preamble. So it's in that sense dedicated. The problem for them is they conceded, and this was partly because of prosecution history, that for dedicated under the patent claims, it has to be dedicated for the entire 26 millisecond RACE procedure. That is not true of LTE. It is dedicated for a particular time slot. That's why the only risk of collision is where there's the same preamble in adjacent time slots, and that's what we presented evidence on. So that's our four grounds for affirming the non-infringement judgment. Going to the questions from the bench about whether that should apply to the LTE products. Remember, the license and exhaustion holding was at the summary judgment stage.
Did you mean to the Qualcomm products?
The Qualcomm chip products. I'm sorry, I just misspoke. The license and exhaustion ruling happened at the summary judgment stage. This wasn't a motion to dismiss. They had already released their infringement contentions. Expert reports had already been produced. They have no other theory other than all of these products, Qualcomm or not, have LTE and LTE reads on the patent claims. That's their only theory. They've had two briefs in this court to tell the court a different theory that they might have had below, and now at the podium.
Discovery was closed. It was just a few weeks before trial. At least that's what opposing counsel
correct,
said.
Your Honor.
Okay.
When Judge Gilstrap issued the summary judgment order?
It was after discovery, after summary judgment.
His order came out 2 weeks before
trial. Oh, I don't know if it was 2 weeks. I thought it was shortly before trial, but I may be misremembering that. I thought they were both in the fall of 2023, but I may be, or 2024, but I may be misremembering that.
In a hypothetical world where we agree with you on the non-infringement, and we don't reach the license, would it be an abuse of discretion for Judge Gilstrap to say, okay, now one of you has to file a motion to say what the impact of the Federal Circuit's ruling is on the Qualcomm products, and perhaps you win, but I'm unclear on whether we can or should do that rather than send it back for you all to have this fight, maybe a very quick fight.
Okay, so let me. There's a couple pieces of that I want to unpack. One, I think the court would have to have essentially reversed on the license exhaustion to even send it back, because otherwise we would just be entitled to affirmance on that. I'm not sure the court could do like a limited remand process. Maybe I don't want to say the court couldn't do it, but that seems unusual to me. So if the court were to reverse on license exhaustion and send it back, I do not think it would be an abuse of discretion for Judge Gilstrap to ask for essentially a ministerial motion. I do think it would be an abuse of discretion for him to deny that motion because they have presented no other theories. And for that very reason, I think it is well open to this court to affirm on that alternative ground. The analogy I've thought of in sort of a non-patent context is if there was a tort claim and part of the period of damages was dismissed at the summary judgment stage under the statute of limitations, and then the defendant went on to win at trial on a ground that applies equally to all claims, like intent was lacking, and it came up to an appellate court. I don't think the appellate court would feel that it couldn't affirm the entire judgment without reaching the statute of limitations issue on the ground of the verdict, at least if, as here, the other side has presented no possible basis to think that it would not apply.
So it sounds like, counsel, you're contending that we don't need to reach the license agreement at all. Is that what I'm hearing?
I think it would be sufficient. I don't think you'd need to. I think it would be sufficient to affirm the non-infringement piece of the judgment on the new trial and then extend it to the Qualcomm chips. I do think it has the court has discretion to reach the license exhaustion issue as an alternative ground to affirm. From our perspective, we'd like the court to reach that because the license issue could matter to us in the future, in theory. But I do think the court has discretion to affirm solely on new trial and on extending the verdict, I think inevitably, to the Qualcomm chip products and could rest the non-infringement piece on that.
What if we determined that the district court abused its discretion by saying that Evolved waived its arguments about Section 17.2 in the Delaware case? But we do not think that the district court erred in terms of its contract interpretation. What do you think we should do in that situation?
That's a full affirmance, Judge Cunningham, because Judge Gilstrap issued alternative grounds to reject that argument. He both issued this waiver ruling, and then he also said the argument lacks merit. And actually, in this case, on all these waiver issues here, there's a couple different waiver issues. I actually think the merits are even more straightforward than the waiver issues on all of these. That one's a great example. So 5.3 says what it says. Assume we're right about that, that extends it to the life of the patent. On this argument, Evolved is saying that 6 years later, the parties enacted another provision in 2010, 17.2, that said basically tell the transferee about this license that's running with the patent and get their assent. And that somehow conditions the 5.3 life of the patent. There's literally no language in the agreement that remotely says that. It's perfectly sensible that the parties would want a provision like that just to avoid litigation, just to make sure the transferee is on record saying, I agree with this license running the patent. There's no language whatsoever in the 2010 amendment that says it's conditioning 5.3 on the 7.2 requirement. So I actually think on that one, the merits are a far easier basis to affirm.
You had this other waiver argument with respect to Evolved not putting something in, I think, the contention interrogatory. Is that another?
So Judge Gilstrap did not rely on this. We've provided the court two alternative arguments to justify the waiver holding. I actually think the stronger of those is the complaint in this case. So paragraph 57 of Evolved's complaint, which is found at page 377 of the appendix, Evolved said that these patents were subject to a license or to a covenant until termination. I don't know if they're going to dispute my reading. I think it's pretty clear that's what that paragraph is saying. And that's not a prior case, and that's not an interrogatory response. That is a filing and a pleading in the case.
Well, in their briefs to us, they repeatedly say that the license agreement terminated in 2018, but yet their 17.2 argument seems to mean it kind of terminated in 2014. So would that not be a further basis for waiver? I know you didn't argue that.
I had not thought of that. I will accept that as a further basis for waiver. I think that's, well,
maybe
that's a good point.
Maybe we have a waiver of that.
May have a waiver of the waiver. It's true. But I think there's plenty of grounds for waiver here, but I also just think the merits of that issue is particularly simple. There's just nothing
in 17. Talk about the merits of 17.2 for a minute, because I had thought it was undisputed that, putting aside whether there's conditionality, but the actual things that are supposed to be done to make the transfer or upon the transfer, the certain notice and the written consent, or written acknowledgement, I guess. It's undisputed that those things did not happen. Isn't that correct?
Correct.
So what did Judge Gilstrap say about why that's not a problem?
The 7.2, I think his reasoning was 17.2 does not condition the 5.3 life of the patent. Because to think that, you'd have to think that in 2004, assuming we're right on the first step of this, the parties said the covenants in 5.1 and 5.2 will run to the life of the patent with the transfer. And then in 2010, they enacted these requirements, which are really additional protections for Qualcomm, and somehow conditioned the 5.3 running with the life of the patent on 17.2 with literally saying nothing whatsoever to that effect. They have some argument about the word subject to. I couldn't really follow what they were saying. I mean, both clauses say the word subject to, but I don't think that means it's one is conditioned on the other, especially given the temporal gap. I mean, you'd have to think they basically carved out 5.3 in a major way without saying that. I don't think that works. I think I'm well into my rebuttal time, but I'm happy.
The other side is going to get a little extra time.
You have a cross appeal.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to address either licensing or the cross appeal issues if the court's interested in either. Otherwise, I will just go on to invalidity.
Just for clarification, is your cross appeal conditional?
We did not make it conditional, and the reason, Judge Chen, is that although we did not file a declaratory judgment counterclaim, the judgment in this case has a finding or a judgment about validity in it. So I think at minimum we'd be entitled to vacatur of that sentence, even if the court doesn't reach the merits of validity because it decides in its discretion does not need to do it. I do think the court's case law is...
Let me just ask you today, though, if we were to agree with you and you win on the other ground, do we need to reach your cross appeal?
I've looked at this in preparation for the argument. I think the court's precedent on this is not entirely clear to me. There's a footnote in a case from 4 years ago called Next Step.
Are you still saying that you would like us to reach it? That's the question.
We would like you to declare the patent invalid, certainly. At minimum, we'd like the court to strike the part of the judgment that reaches invalidity, even if the court chooses not to reach the validity question, so that that judgment is not hanging out there. But we would like the court, in its discretion, to reach the validity question. It could matter in other cases. And I'm happy to give you just the highlight of our argument on why the patent is invalid.
I think we have it.
You have it.
Brief.
Well, then, unless there are further questions at this time, I'll reserve any time I have for rebuttal. I think I have a cross-appeal rebuttal.
Very good. Yeah, I guess you technically do. Okay.
Thank you.
3 minutes.
On the question of whether the court should reach the license issue regardless of infringement, given that first of all, it sounds like the parties both agree that we would like the court to provide finality and guidance on that issue. So I'd flag that. Second, because there is no non-infringement finding in the current judgment, Samsung would be asking for broader relief, which I believe would require a cross-appeal on that issue, which would in turn have required presenting and getting a ruling from the district court on that issue. And so we think for that reason as well, really the court, even if that's a technical reason why a remand is required, I think it's an important jurisdictional reason why a remand would be required if this court reverses on the license. I wanted to go then to infringement. Judge Chin asked what the standard says about this dedicated preamble, and there was an argument about how there was evidence that the preamble is not dedicated for the entire 26 millisecond handover procedure. We disagree, and as far as what the standard says on that, it's found in Appendix 11846, which is a standard specification saying that the phone, quote, uses the dedicated preamble until the handover procedure is finished. Our expert presented that standard spec to the jury, and we believe that's the only evidence in the record with respect to how long the preamble is dedicated during the handover procedure.
Could you explain the apparent concession at A3834, where your expert apparently agreed that within the same random access channel procedure, two different phones can have the same preamble index inside the random access channel procedure by using different time slots?
Yes, Your Honor. And we believe that that is a recognition that phones are able to perform both the infringing contention-free procedure and the conventional contention-based procedure. What the expert is saying there is, yes, there is a scenario where the phone is performing a conventional contention-based handover, and in that scenario, two phones can have the same preamble at the same time. He did not concede that in the accused procedure, two phones can have the same preamble at the same time. He unequivocally...
But this is something that can occur under the LTE standard.
It is a way that the phones can function, but they still must be configured for or and therefore capable of infringing operation.
Last thoughts?
No, Your Honor, I'll conclude there.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
I know.
There was nothing on.
I will be very brief, Your Honor. When the courts leave...
Wait a second. Why are you here?
I'm sorry.
You're going to talk about written description
There was nothing already.
But I was going to say, with the court's leave, I would respond to two things from the podium, but if the court thinks it's inappropriate based on the nature of the cross-appeal, I will not.
You're limited to the cross-appeal at this moment.
Okay, well, I'll give a couple sentences on why the written description is...
No, you need to sit down.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He didn't
address it. Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case is submitted.